What I want to do this evening is to, at a certain point, take up from where I left off last time I was here 2 years ago, and then end, because I don't have that many new ideas really, so, and then I want to move on from there to talk a little bit about productivity. I noted with interest in some of the seeded material that you have a productivity program that's going to engage Gary Banks. I can't think of anyone better. And so I want to, in the end of my remarks tonight, come to productivity. But to begin, it's 5 years now that financial markets and policymakers have been living in a more or less continual state of anxiety. It was poor lending practices into the US mortgage market that was the root of at least the initial problems in this episode. But pretty early on it became apparent that European banks also had serious difficulties. That was because of their exposure to securities of doubtful quality, particularly American ones, high leverage, and the need to fund US dollar-denominated positions on a short-term basis. And it was in August of 2007, really, that the crisis proper really began, when those acute funding difficulties for European banks suddenly became clear in financial markets. Well, 5 years on, and American banks have made a lot of progress in working through their asset quality problems and their capital deficiencies. At times that process was not pretty, but the US system is in a much better place today as a result. And indeed, US taxpayers have even earned a positive return on their investments in American banks made at the peak of the crisis. In Europe, progress has been rather slower. There are a number of reasons for that, not least the sheer complexity of coordinating the process of evaluating and strengthening balance sheets in so many countries, where the national capacities to respond and to contribute are so different, and all of that within the strictures of a currency union. And suffice to say that that's a very complex set of problems, and there are negative feedback loops between the economy shrinking, that affecting bank asset quality and affecting fiscal solvency, which then feeds back into the economy and so on. So it's no surprise that probably for the past year at least, the news has been dominated, it seems, by the ebb and flow of anxiety over things like will the Troika approve the next round of funding for Greece? Will a German constitutional court strike down the German government's efforts to assist the region? Will the populace in some country or other, under great stress, take to the streets and reach the end of their tolerance for austerity, and so on? So there's event risk, so to speak, in Europe almost weekly. That is the European drama. Unfortunately, my sense is that it's set to continue like that for quite some time. It's true that over recent months, financial sentiment has improved from despair to mere gloom as a result of a number of important steps that were taken and commitments that have been made. And it's right, actually, that sentiment has improved, because that recognises the determination of the Europeans to save the euro, and we shouldn't underestimate the strength of that determination. But there is so much more to do, and it will take a considerable time to do it. So while good progress is being made, we will not anytime soon, I don't think, see a point at which the euro problems can be seen as now in the past. I think that's going to take quite a long time. And so the world and all of us will have to live with euro area anxiety as a normal state of affairs for some time. In the meantime, the US economy has continued its slow healing. The US housing sector, I think it's increasingly clear, has finally turned, and that's been a major headwind for the US until now. The election is now passed, and with that, the so-called fiscal cliff has rapidly come into focus. This is a new source of event risk, and we will read a lot about this in the next 6 or 7 weeks. But if one is prepared to assume that the US political process won't ultimately, in the end, actually preside over a massive unintended fiscal contraction at the beginning of next year, then, if you're prepared to assume that, the risks to the US economy probably look more balanced at the moment than they have for a while. That is to say, an upside surprise would be as likely as a downside one, and it's probably been a while since one could have said that. It would be fascinating if, in another year, you're here at another dinner like this, and you find yourselves looking back at a US economy that had outperformed expectations. There is, of course, still a critical need for the United States to craft a measured and credible path back to fiscal sustainability. That particular drama, I suspect, may last just about as long as the European one. It is appropriate, though, having said those things, to turn our gaze to our own part of the world, especially in the current period of discussion on the Asian century. 2 years ago, when I last spoke at this gathering, I showed a chart. And what I'd like to do is to go back to that graph. Those of you who are here may remember it. This is Australia's terms of trade since 1870. And we have annual data and a 5-year moving average of that annual data. Well, I can update that chart for you tonight. And the updated version looks like that. So the terms of trade, having already risen a fair bit, one might say, well, we'd say not inconsiderably, being central bankers, that's probably what we'd say, has in fact gone even higher. They have started to come down from the peak, but as it turns out, these are annual data, but the quarterly data for the September quarter, which is the latest quarter for which we have the figures, is in fact 7% higher in that quarter than the quarterly number which was embodied in the forecast I had 2 years ago. This event is sufficiently unusual, in fact, that we can add a little tweak to this chart. Instead of just a 5-year centred moving average, we can have a decade-long one. And that's what this does. And what that does is it kind of flattens down some of those previous episodes that didn't last so long. And it emphasises not so much how high the terms of trade have gone this time, but how long they're there. It's an 11-centre moving average for the kind of technical people among you, because we want to centre it, so you need an odd number of years in the moving average, and that's why it shows 11, but you can think of that as a decade average. To compute that, of course, we have to make a 5-year ahead assumption. Well, we forecast about 3 years out, and we've, you know, sort of added a little bit to that. Basically, assuming that commodity prices fall a bit faster than is implied by the forecasts of private analysts. Even if that occurs, what this is telling you is that over a 10-year period, by the time this is over, the terms of trade will have been 50% higher for 10 years on average than they were for the preceding century on average. That, ladies and gentlemen, is a big deal. I could make a more pessimistic... That's the actual assumption we've made. If we assume this one, which is twice as big a fall, what that does to the 10-year moving average is that. So it's a big deal. It is easily the largest and most persistent terms of trade event for a very long time, quite possibly since European settlement of Australia. That's why we've been banging on about it for so long. It's a fundamental realignment of relative prices in the global economy. It affects the structure of all economies, including this one. On the whole, it's advantageous to Australia because a rise in the terms of trade is a rise in real income. And that's why we've talked about it so much. Still, it's time to say, and we've been saying for a while, the terms of trade have peaked. They peaked a year ago. By the end of this year, they probably will have fallen by about 15% from the peak. Further declines over time are likely. So while a high level of the terms of trade will continue to hold up the level of our national income, we can no longer expect that a rising terms of trade will be adding to growth in our living standards. We're entering a new phase. Now, that's not really at this point so much because of the so-called end of the mining boom. As a matter of fact, talk of the end of the mining boom is a bit overhyped. The boom isn't ending so much as just evolving more or less in a way that you might expect these events to do. Thoughtful commentators have already pointed out a number of times that there are in fact three phases to the mining boom. The first phase is the price part, and that's what this is showing. The rise in natural resource prices in fact began as far back as about 2004. The peak in prices, as I've said, was a year ago, a bit more than that now. And in fact, the Reserve Bank has been saying in our monthly statements after each board meeting since October of last year that prices had declined. That said, relative prices for natural resources, which is what our terms of trade is, are still high. At this point, just where the blue is here, well, actually, these are annual data. If I put the quarterly data on, we are back down now to the peak of 2008, which was, of course, a 50-year high. So they're still high. So that's the prices. The prices have peaked. They've come down. They will fall further. The second phase of the boom, of course, is the rise in physical investment in the resource sector to take advantage of the fact that prices are high. That's aimed at taking advantage of high demand and hopefully pretty high prices, even if not peak prices, into the future. The peak in the investment build-up is in fact still ahead of us. It's not far ahead now. We've felt for some time that the peak would likely be in 2013 or 2014. And that expectation seems to be firming up. The level of the peak is probably going to be a bit lower now than we thought 6 or 9 months ago. And that's in view of the fact that prices have come down for commodities and they've been more variable, and boards of directors of resource companies, not to mention their lenders, have become more conservative, understandably. That's a material revision to the outlook in a near-term sense, but it's worth putting this into perspective. For 50 years, mining investment was between 1 and 2% of GDP, with occasional peaks at 3%. You can see a peak there in the late 60s, another one with the ill-fated resources boom of the early 80s. Peaks were 3%. Right now, what we're uncertain about is whether this boom is going to peak at 9% or only 8%. What isn't uncertain is that either of those is a very, very large number by any historical standard. So this also is a big deal. It's worth observing as well that in any episode like this, there is always going to come a point when some potential projects, conceived at the time when prices are at their highest and the sky looks blue, and just before costs of doing projects really start to escalate, a number of projects conceived at that moment are going to end up having to be shelved. Actually, if projects rely on extremes of pricing, it's probably better that they be shelved before they get too far. And that's one of the things that we're starting to see come onto the horizon now. I think the other general thing to say is that some important parts of the resources sector have now reached a point where the costs of further expansion in capacity in Australia relative to the cost of doing it elsewhere in the world are a much more important factor in investment decisions than they might have been a couple of years ago. So that's the second phase of the boom. The third phase, which is really just getting started, is when the capacity to extract and export the resources is actually used. That's begun, but much of it lies ahead, especially in the case of a commodity like, say, natural gas. The main uncertainty here really is over what the prices will be that will be achieved for those resources as additional supply, and not only Australian supply, but supply elsewhere as well, comes on stream. Well, that uncertainty is there. It's always been there and always will be part and parcel of the business of extracting natural resources. Perhaps what people have found a little unnerving over the past year is that as the prospect of rising supply gets closer and prices have come down, albeit remaining pretty high in most cases, we've also seen the Chinese economy in transition to slower growth. Now, it was inevitable, actually, that China would slow to some extent from the very rapid pace seen for much of the past decade. The signs that it needed to slow were quite evident. Rising inflation, an incipient bubble, if not an actual bubble, in the property sector, doubts about the process of credit growth and credit management, and so on. So there had to be a slowing. But just how big a slowing was occurring? That was the question. That's the question, really, that most people have been grappling with for this year or more, probably for the last 12 months or so. My assessment is that the slowdown has been more material than had been expected a year ago, but not disastrously so. There are some signs that the moderation might have run its course now, actually, though that's a very preliminary assessment and further data would be needed before such a view could be offered with confidence. So the Chinese economy has not crashed, but neither is it likely to return to the sorts of double-digit percentage rates of growth in GDP and the 15% odd rates of growth for industrial production that we saw for quite a few years. People expecting that to resume are going to, I think, be disappointed. These trends are entirely consistent with two propositions which we have advanced on a number of occasions over recent years. The first is that China's economy would have and does have an important and increasing weight in the regional and global economies. China's real GDP, as measured to the extent we can accept those data, and they're the only data there are, its real GDP is almost three times what it was a decade ago. It follows from that even modest growth in China today carries considerably more weight for the global economy than rapid growth might have 10 years ago. If China grows by only 7% in 2013, that will add more to global GDP than 10% growth did in China 10 years earlier in 2003. 10 years ago, that 10% growth added about 0.75 percentage point to global GDP. 7% growth next year, if that occurred, would add a full percentage point to global GDP. The second proposition that we've held is that China, like every other economy, has a business cycle. It's affected by what happens elsewhere in the world, and it has been affected over the past year by the slowing in the advanced countries. It's affected by its own internal dynamics, including by what its policymakers decide, and there's no doubt that a good part of the Chinese slowdown was intentional on the part of the policymakers there for good reason. Swings in China's performance are increasingly affecting Australia's economy and that of our region and the world. In fact, the focus on the monthly data reports from China these days in our business press, in addition to the focus on things like the leadership transition that we've just seen, is quite striking. The Chinese Purchasing Managers Index, a measure of manufacturing activity, the Chinese version of that is at least as keenly awaited, I would say, as the US version is these days. The US version, it's a US PMI, it's actually called ISM, and I can remember when it used to be called NAPM, so there it is. But the Chinese version of that sort of thing, I'd say, is probably more market moving over the past year for us than the US one, and there is some tentative evidence, it's only tentative now, starting to emerge that Chinese data surprises have become increasingly influential in driving the exchange rate and the share market. Well, turning then to Australia, when I was here 2 years ago, I noted that we could not know how much of the rise in the terms of trade was permanent, and that there was therefore a case to save a good proportion of the additional income until we did have a sense of how permanent it was. Now, in a manner of speaking, we've kind of done that, actually, as a country. Whether that was our intention or not, that's sort of been the outcome. The marked rise in the saving rate of households that happened in 2008 and 9 has remained. Corporations have increased their saving and run down their leverage. Not that leverage was excessive, really, other than in a few celebrated instances, but corporations have been conservative. Admittedly, government savings been lower for countercyclical reasons, but that too is now scheduled to rise. And for the nation as a whole, the fact that the current account deficit has been lower on average in the past 5 years than it was in the preceding 20 years, at the same time as the share of business investment in GDP has been exceptionally high, that tells you that national saving has actually gone up. In fact, national saving has been in recent years at its highest share of national income since the late 1980s. That change can, I think, in one sense, be seen as a sensible response to an unusually high level of the terms of trade while you're trying to work out how permanent that income is. Something else has also been at work, though, in household behaviour, and I've talked about this on a number of occasions before, but it is worth repeating because it is, I think, fundamental to understanding the current economic situation. After a period, quite a lengthy period, in which high levels of confidence, macroeconomic stability, easy availability of credit, and rising asset values saw Australians borrow more and save less, in the past 5 years they've been going back the other way. They've been borrowing less and saving more. That is, they've changed their behaviour on spending, saving and borrowing back towards what used to once be thought of as normal. Now, that really had nothing to do with the resources boom, but it's had important implications for key business sectors. Think about financial institutions. They're now finding that the normal rate of credit growth is a single-digit number, not a double-digit one, as it had been for quite a long time. Businesses which, in the earlier period of optimism, derived earnings from high rates of turnover in asset markets, think about real estate agents or stockbrokers, face challenges now that turnover is much lower. The retail sector, as we keep hearing, faces different consumers. It isn't actually that the consumers have no money to spend, nor is it, frankly, that their confidence is that low, nor that their saving rate is that high. We have these measures of confidence back to the mid-1970s. They're at about their average level at the moment. The household saving rate shown here, well, 10%, is actually not that high in comparison to much of the history. This is the history for the current national accounts, which go back to 1960. The really high saving rates were in the 60s and 70s. To be sure, confidence was unusually strong for an unusually long time in the pre-crisis period, and saving was very low. As you can see here, it fell more or less to zero at one point. But folks, that was unusual, and I don't think that behaviour will come back. In addition to that, consumers are much more knowledgeable now as a result of information technology about prices, and they have at their disposal ways of responding to that knowledge that a decade ago they didn't have. You know, the prices, they're all on here, and I can order them on here. These changes are putting pressure on retail business models, and I think that is going right back up through the value chain to wholesaling, distribution, and retail property. And that's one of the things that we see, resulting from a combination of changed household behaviour, back to much more normal behaviour historically, and of course the high exchange rate, and information technology all combining. Given that that change to household behaviour was surely inevitable, it isn't normal to save nothing from income. Sooner or later, saving was going to rise again. Given that that was inevitable, the income boost we've had from the terms of trade arrived, I would say, at a rather fortuitous time. It helped to accommodate a rise in household saving and a slowdown in the build-up of debt in a fairly benign fashion. We can also see that the weakness of some other parts of private spending and our openness to imports and a high exchange rate has also meant that a very large investment, pickup in mining investment that I showed earlier, has been accommodated without overheating the economy overall. That's actually pretty unusual in the history of these things. As it was, real private final demand in Australia last year, 2011-12, rose by 6%. That is way above trend and way above the economy's potential to grow its supply capability, which is more like 3-point-something. But now the peak in the investment boom is coming into view. And so the question naturally arises as to how will the balance between the various types of demand in the economy unfold? Mining investment will contribute less to growth this fiscal year than last, and then less again next year. Going in the other direction, it's likely that exports of resources in volume terms will start to pick up as the new capacity is used. That will show up as GDP growth, though it might be predominantly reflected as higher measured productivity rather than generating a large volume of extra employment. The question then will be whether or what happens to other areas of demand. Well, indebted households have made some progress in reducing their debt burdens. At some point, that may be expected to lead to those households feeling a little more inclined to spend. I think that's right. But in addition, a complex interaction of factors, which would include asset values not being as high as they were and expectations or uncertainties about job security, those sorts of things also will be at work in ways which are not amenable to accurate short-term forecasting. So the assumption we're making basically is that consumption will continue to grow roughly in line with income, which it's been doing for the past year or two. Public demand, of course, is scheduled to be subdued because governments are trying to put budget positions back to surplus in line with their medium-term commitments. The outlook for business investment spending apart from the resource sector, in all frankness, according to the best leading indicators we have, is pretty subdued right now. Now, as a cyclical phenomenon, history is that that sort of investment is usually slow to turn. That's been the case in many cycles, and this one looks like it will be no exception. The exchange rate may have also some role to play in helping the needed rebalancing. While it is not surprising that the Australian dollar has been very strong over recent years given the terms of trade event we've had, it is surprising that it hasn't declined much, at least so far, given that the terms of trade have peaked more than a year ago. Of course, a lower exchange rate, if that happened, would need to be accompanied by a pace of growth of domestic unit costs below what we've seen for much of the past 5 years in order to maintain low inflation, which of course it is our very firm intention to do. One area of stronger potential demand growth that we might see is dwelling investment, which has been unusually weak. I'm not sure actually that the degree of that weakness has been satisfactorily explained. Various explanations have been put forward, ranging from interest rates were too high, house prices were falling, zoning restrictions, planning delays, construction costs, lack of confidence. All these have featured in the various explanations that have been put forward. At present, though, at least some of the preconditions one might expect to be needed for higher construction seem to be coming into place. Interest rates have declined. Dwelling prices appear to have stopped falling. Rental yields have risen, so the equation for investors is improving. And the availability of tradespeople has improved. And we have seen a rise in approvals to build. It's true that much of that's been in the very variable, volatile, multi-unit sector, but actually much more of the action is in that sector these days normally. It's harder to distill the trend as a result, but there is actually evidence of a turning point, albeit a belated one. Well, will the net effect of these development mean... will the net effect of all this be that aggregate demand rises roughly in line with the economy's supply capacity over the next couple of years, or will a gap between the two emerge? Well, that's really the question that the Reserve Bank seeks to answer every time we sit down to decide monetary policy. At the most recent meeting, as the minutes released today show, the board felt that further easing might be required over time. The board was also conscious, though, that a significant easing of policy had already been put in place over the past year, and the effects of that are still coming through and will be for a while. In addition, the latest inflation data, while not in themselves a major problem, were higher than expected, and the gloom in the global economy has lifted a bit, at least for the moment. So it seemed to the board prudent, given all that, to sit still for the time being. Looking ahead, the question we'll be asking is whether the current settings will appropriately foster conditions that will be consistent with our objectives, that is, sustainable growth and inflation at 2 to 3% over time. Over the long run, though, the bigger question, the really big question for all of us here and for the business community and the policy-making community more broadly, isn't the monthly interest rate decision, as fun as it might be to speculate about that. The really big question is, what is the sustainable rate of growth of the economy and how might we increase that? That's really the question. Beyond its role of preserving the value of money, monetary policy really can't do much about the sustainable rate of growth of the economy. It is what it is, and we take it as a given, and other policies have to be devoted to increasing that sustainable growth rate if that's what we want to do. Moreover, the initial contribution of rising mineral prices to our standard of living has now run its course, as I've said earlier. Certainly, a larger capital stock in the resources sector, which we are going to have for a long time, will make its contribution to the level of our living standards for many years, to the extent that Australians either own some of that capital, work with it, or can tax some of the proceeds. But the biggest contribution to growing our living standards will be what it's always been, other than in periods of exceptional luck, and they don't last long, and that is productivity performance. At the last dinner that I had here 2 years ago, I said that while our terms of trade are handed to us, for better or worse, by international relative prices, the efficiency with which we work is a variable we can actually do something about. Now, for some years, there's been evidence of a slowdown in productivity growth. As shown here, this is the level of productivity, its output per hour worked in the market sector, and I've stripped out mining and utilities because there are some very unusual things happening there. But it's hard to avoid the conclusion that for 7 or 8 years the trend pace of growth is considerably lower than it had been in the decade prior to that. If you look carefully, right at the end, in the last observation in 2011-12, there's a lift in the slope of the blue line. That is to say, productivity growth picked up in the latest year. That's very encouraging. Of course, it's way too soon to conclude that a new, stronger trend is now in place. In the field of measuring productivity, given its potential to be cyclical, variable, and very hard to measure, you need long runs of data to draw conclusions. In my opinion, the accelerated structural change we are seeing in the economy will result in stronger productivity performance. That's my opinion. But the most one could say at present is that the data in the last year are not inconsistent with that hypothesis, but they certainly don't prove it. Now, at this point, we're talking about productivity. I usually get circumspect, having said that. And the reason is that I know that in an audience like this, people may ask, what can we do to improve productivity performance? And I'm acutely aware that improvement in productivity, if it happens, it's going to be delivered in enterprises. The enterprises that people like you run, and millions more around the country besides. Productivity doesn't pick up simply because the central bank exhorts it so, and it doesn't pick up because of some official pronouncement. It has to be delivered by enterprises, their managements, their boards, their employees, and their technologies over time. As for policy measures, well, at a meeting in Brisbane in the middle of this year, I said, off the cuff in answer to a question, quote, the Productivity Commission has a long list of things to do. My answer to what we can do about productivity is, go get the lists and do them, unquote. That comment elicited, it's fair to say, a good deal of attention. The chairman of the Productivity Commission was, I'm led to believe, inundated with media demands. Can we have the list? And he had to explain that he didn't quite have a list in that form. But very helpfully, Gary Banks has, in fact, kindly drawn up a list, which he's promulgated in his final speech at the end of a very distinguished tenure as chairman of the Productivity Commission just a few weeks ago. His list is a rather more complete one than anything I could draw up. In fact, it's three lists, each under a heading. There's a list of things that affect incentives, there's a list of things that affect capabilities, and there's a list of things that affect flexibility. What I found most striking reading through, and I commend that speech to you if you haven't read it, what was most striking to me was the comment in the conclusion that no single policy offered the secret to success. He's obviously been asked by people, what's the one big thing we could do? And I'm often asked that too. And here was his answer. No single thing is the secret. And to quote, rather, what is needed is an approach to productivity policy that embraces both the drivers and enablers of firm performance, firm level performance, and is consistently applied. That in turn requires policy-making processes that can achieve clarity about problems, reach agreed objectives, and ensure the proper testing of proposed solutions. the beneficial and enduring structural reforms of the 1980s and 1990s are testimony to the value of these policy-making fundamentals. Good process in policy formulation is accordingly the most important thing of all on the to-do list if we are serious about securing Australia's future productivity and the prosperity that depends on it. Well, ladies and gentlemen, it could not have been better expressed. As the mining boom moves from its second to its third phase over the next year or two, the world economy will continue to present its own challenges. Australia will, as always, need to adapt to the changing circumstances. Looking much further ahead to the Asian century, our opportunities are large. But to grasp them, that same adaptability, combined with a clear focus and steadiness of purpose, will be key. We have to produce our sought-after prosperity. It won't just come to us. All of us have our role to play, and I'm very pleased to see that CEDA in particular has a productivity program. I think CEDA as an organisation has a role to play. All of the enterprises represented here have a role to play. The policy-making community has its role to play. And I wish you all great success in playing that role. Thank you for your attention and compliments of the season. Thank you.
Ross Barker from Australian Foundation Investment Company. Governor, how concerned are you over the medium to long term about the level of monetary stimulus going on around the world and the implications that ultimately might have for inflation?
Well, there's certainly attempts being made by the major countries to stimulate economies which are facing severe financial dislocation, potential threat of inflation being too low, possibly even deflation. That's why the Fed, Bank of Japan, ECB, UK are doing these things. I suppose what we were taught in the textbook was large monetary expansion is, to use Friedman's words, always and everywhere inflationary. But I think the thing we can't observe at the moment is the counterfactual of what would have happened in the absence of these measures. I think the central banks concerned would claim that the price level would be much lower, and so what they're doing is inflationary compared with that, but that unobservable baseline scenario is not observable and you wouldn't want to experience it, and so their claim would be they've headed that off. I think there's room for a fair bit of discussion actually about how effective these measures are. I think there's a fair bit of what we once learned about as pushing on a string, really, about what's happening, but they have to do what they can. Whether it proves ultimately to be inflationary, it's a good question. The Bank of Japan has been doing this. They've had zero interest rates since about 1999 or 2000. They've had quantitative easing for a little bit shorter time than that, but still quite a long time. They're still deflating. So in their case, it's proven very difficult to generate the inflation that they actually say they're seeking. So it's hard to say. There will at some point need to be an exit plan. And I think the Fed probably has thought a lot about this. And I think they would say that at a technical level, they know how to go about reversing this out when the time comes. There'll always be a judgment call as to when's the right time to do that, but in any cycle where you tighten monetary policy, you've got that call. So that, in a sense, is it's not an unknown problem. The difficulty might be that by then a lot of people have gotten very used to very, very cheap money, not least their government, and that may create complications. In between then and now, we may well face a very long period of very, very low rates in these major countries, which I think one has to say is doing damage to the world's retirement income system and the insurance system, because there's no yield anywhere. And I'm not that I find a bit troubling without being able to fully articulate what all the costs might be. But I think we will be discussing those potential costs of these policies over the years ahead, which isn't to say that they're doing the wrong thing by pursuing these policies, but there are costs and benefits to be weighed.
Thank you. Question over here? Was there? No? Further questions?
I'm going to get an early mark. No.
David DeGareth from National Australia Bank, Governor. I've got a question about consumer sentiment and consumer confidence, that graph that we've seen since 2008-09, the household savings ratio has been broadly constant, at least according to the National Accounts measure, and yet some other confidence surveys suggesting that people are still quite cautious, which is sort of like what I'm hearing from the street as well. The asset markets are sort of choppy at best. If you were to be called by the Treasurer tonight and said, I understand your forecast is for the household savings ratio to broadly remain unchanged, where do you think the risk lies in the next 2 to 5 years with that household savings ratio? Are we going back to where we were in the 60s or 70s, or are we just going to hang about where we are here, or people about to unlock and start spending again?
Well, no one knows, David. I think my comment, I have two comments. The first is that it is a common saying that consumers are cautious. Enough people say that obviously many people believe it. But actually the index that's supposed to measure it is at pretty much its long-run average. So I think we got used to a particularly ebullient period, and we've come to think of that as normal, but it wasn't really normal. Secondly, and relatedly, I don't know whether 10% saving rate is optimal, correct, or sustainable. It strikes me, though, as much, much more normal and likely to be persistent than zero, which is where we were. And I think in the long run we have to count as a strength that the household sector is taking, a much more prudent course with its attitude to saving and borrowing, as difficult as that is in the short term for some sectors to adjust to. It actually builds resilience for the future, whereas I think what we were doing before was we were degrading our resilience as households. So, but no particular quantitative contribution. Probably the worst forecast variable in economics is the exchange rate. That's just to head off the question that's otherwise going to get asked. The second worst one is probably the saving rate.
Other questions? Over here.
Glenn Robert Gottliebson from Business Spectator. I think in your graphs, on four previous occasions, there were spikes in the terms of trade. They both went up and down again. This one has gone up and stayed up longer. But do you think the enormous energy discoveries in the Middle East and the enormous energy discoveries in America threaten another very sharp fall in our terms of trade because they'll reduce the price of gas and coal?
I don't know, Bob. I think the... We too see the intelligence that says that the gas phenomenon in the US is quite transformative for that country. That's actually another reason to suspect that the US could eventually surprise us on the upside, because in that country there's nothing like cheap energy to kind of get things going. So there'll be more supply. You've still got to think about demand as well. And the Asian demand, that isn't just China but Asia generally, demand for energy will also likely rise a lot. So how the net of those two things will work out, I don't know. I certainly fully accept the point that history says that the terms of trade, they don't stay super high indefinitely, they come down. My point was simply this episode, more or less, or whatever happens from here, has been a very unusual, very big and quite persistent one, and that's a big part of the story of the economy over recent years. That's my main point. I'm not saying the terms... I would say that our standard presumption is they will fall. They won't fall all the way back. They'll be lower than they are today and probably higher than the mean over history. But, you know, that could be wrong. If it is wrong, then the economy will have to adjust to that as it unfolds. It's ever been thus.
Other questions? Just here.
Stephen Martin from CETA. Governor, in your earlier comments you talked about current circumstances in Europe. I think this week's Economist magazine talks about, in a 10-page spread, issues associated with France and the impact that decisions being taken by the current government potentially could have not only on the future of the euro, but again, a major economy that seems to be going counter-cyclical to what the Germans are looking at. Have you got any comments as to likely impact that some of the political decisions translating into economic decisions are having in France, as it may affect the overall composition of the euro and perhaps what that then might mean for Australia?
That's a pretty big question, and
I'm known for it.
I admit to not being a regular reader of The Economist, so I haven't seen the piece, but I think it is a very difficult time for governments in Europe to, I think, articulate what needs to be done. You know, if you are in a currency union with Germany, and Germany has spent the last 10 years grinding away on costs and getting its productivity up, these people are super competitive. So if you're a couple to that train, you've got to be up to the game, because it's going to be tough otherwise. And that is apart from the banking problems and the government finance problems of countries like Greece and others, the competitiveness problem is acute as well. So there are great tensions there within the Eurozone because of those things. And I don't have any particular comments on an individual government's policies, but it remains true, as every Anglo-Saxon trained economist would say, that if your fundamentals on the supply side of the economy are going in different directions to your trading partners and you're in a currency union, you're going to put acute strain on the system. And really these things have to dovetail, they have to be consistent and coordinated, not uncoordinated, otherwise you're going to run into more trouble. So if they are, in fact, doing the sorts of things that you're implying, it would be troubling for a region which has already got more than its share of difficulties.
Other questions, please?
There's one over there.
Oh, yeah.
Table 5.
Just here.
Thank you. Governor, it's Mark McKenzie from Pitt and Sherry. I was interested in your comments on China, in particular where you're talking about, despite the lower growth, the larger GDP will live with a or produce a greater GDP contribution globally. Do you see a change in the mix of demand that's going to come from China in the near term, or do you think it's still going to be dominated by energy and resources?
Well, I think they're seeking to engineer one important transition, which is to rely less on exporting to the rest of the world and more on generating their own demand at home. The rest of the world is preaching at them to do that, but it's in their interest to do it anyway. An economy of that size cannot keep growing by expecting the rest of the world to absorb that size of a growth of exports continually. So they're making that change. That transition has, I think, some time to go, but it's underway. The resource intensity, or otherwise, of that demand is an interesting question. It's commonly thought, I believe, that while urbanisation continues, you'll have a high steel intensity. I admit to a little bit of uncertainty there because just at a very sort of aggregated level, the steel per unit of China's GDP has already risen to pretty close to where preceding fast developing nations got to before they sort of stabilised. So I would have thought that the steel intensity of GDP doesn't go up much further from here. That still means demand for steel rises 7% a year if in the world's largest market for steel, if GDP grows at that. So it's still quite a big story, but maybe not to the same extent it was. But other people have different views. Some people think that the ongoing urbanisation in the sort of interior parts of the country will still lead to resource-intensive production. And I would imagine generally that society's demand for energy overall will continue to rise because it's a lot lower than ours is per head, and it's quite likely that will keep rising, I'd say.
Other questions? Just over here to the left. We're keeping these people with the microphone fairly fit, I think.
Governor Graham Samuel from Green Hill and more recently Monash University. You commended to us properly, so I think, Gary Banks' last speech, which has an outstanding to-do list in it in terms of productivity. But he gave another speech a few weeks earlier, which got almost as much publicity, when he talked about the proper application of competition policy to labour markets. The publicity perhaps wasn't quite as favourable at that stage from certain sections.
I think he said that, yeah.
How do you react, though, to the issue of the suggestions that we've got more rigidity in our labour markets and that's having a significant effect on labour productivity?
It depends who you ask. In an audience like this, I'd expect that, and I'll get into trouble when I say this, I know exactly what's going to happen, but many people in business say that their perception is that things are more difficult now than they were. That is what people say. I've gotten into a lot of trouble with some other people for repeating that, but that is what people say. There must be something to that. And no, it's a serious point. What I'd say is, let me make one point. I think when we're talking about productivity, which is really the big game, I think it's a mistake to narrow that down solely to it's all about labour market. It isn't all about that. It's about a whole bunch of other things as well in product markets and so on, and Gary's three lists actually go to that. But by the same token, I can't see in logic why labour market arrangements would be excluded from any discussion of these general matters. That, as a matter of logic, doesn't you wouldn't think so. That would be my answer.
Question just down the front here. Here we go.
Heather Carmody from the Nous Group. Glenn, you talked about your organisation's bigger issue really being around not setting interest rates, but more about the question being in terms of sustainable growth and the rate of that and the level of that for the country. So my question is really about, and it follows on a bit from Graham, the conditions under which, or the way in which that debate might reasonably unfold in Australia, and how we get to have a conversation that's bigger than a quarter.
My answer to that has been what we're talking about in terms of raising the sustainable pace of growth is we're talking about faster productivity growth, because that's what does that. You know, we're not coming out of the back of a really large recession where we have a massive amount of unutilised capacity. We've got some, but by and large, from our present point, if we want to speed up the growth of the economy on a sustained basis, it's about raising productivity performance, which is why I get asked by a lot of people, what can we do? And that's why my answer is, you've got a body called the Productivity Commission. They've got, I don't know how many PhDs that spend all their time thinking about this stuff. Let's ask them, because they know about this. It's actually not a very popular answer, because there are vested interests that resist some things the Productivity Commission proposes. One side of politics or the other doesn't like certain things they propose. Many of these things are in the sort of state-federal relations sphere, which is very, very difficult, because it only takes one state minister for whatever to not agree, and it kind of, you know, the thing stalls. So it's very, very hard. But we've got this body whose professional duty is to advise on these things, and my answer is the way to have the conversation is to do a bit more to put them front and centre of it. That strikes me as pretty simple and pretty obvious, but anyway, that's all I have to can say about that, really.
Further questions? One of here, thank you.
Martin Whitten, Nomura. Governor, the Aussie dollar, as you've mentioned, is very high relative to the terms of trade and has been at a sustainably high level for a period of time. Last night we saw the IMF suggesting that the Aussie may be added to its preferred reserve currency names. Given that's taking place, do you have any comment to make on whether that would in the medium term have an upward push for the Australian dollar? And is the spike that we're seeing in deposits from the foreign institutions at the moment at the Reserve Bank indicative of a way of leaning in or passive intervention in the currency?
Well, there's three questions in there, which gives me the option of answering the one I want to, but I'll have a go at the three. Terms of trade and the exchange rate, we've got models, we've got a few. It's a bit high. You wouldn't actually say it's more than a standard deviation away from the mean fit of the model right now, which is why what I've been prepared to say is I think it is a bit on the high side given what's happened. I'm a bit surprised it hasn't come down, which isn't to say it won't do so at some point. And I predict that if it does do so, we will go from complaining about it being too high to complaining about how fast it's falling without passing go. That's my first point. Second point, actually what the IMF said is that in the category of reserve assets that's presently labelled other, they may take Canada and us out of that and label us on our own. that actually isn't any sort of particular endorsement that makes us more of a reserve currency than we were. We've in fact been a small reserve currency for quite a few countries for probably 25 years. The Asian central banks in particular, most of them have had substantial Aussie dollar holdings for quite a while. We don't actually know how much exactly because they don't say, but in fact, if the IMF does this reclassification, we may find out, which would be probably handy. But I don't think there's as much significance to that. It's a classification change. It's not really any more than that. As for the recent so-called passive intervention, let's say that was customer business that we decided to keep on the balance sheet because the prices seemed attractive to do that at this time.
Question over here, thank you.
Thanks, Governor. Ian Satchwell from the University of Western Australia. In the discussion about productivity, one could be forgiven for assuming that it's happening against a static economy. Of course, it's not. And the Australian economy is undergoing some pretty fundamental structural shifts, and according to the Treasury, will continue to do so. What are the implications from your perspective of this structural change for productivity and for other economic factors?
Well, I think that, as I said in the talk, structural change is another name, really, for improving productivity. The reason we do structural change is not because we enjoy it. We don't. The reason it happens is that businesses are under pressure to adapt to change conditions, and they have to do that by lowering costs, raising output per head, being more efficient in order to survive. So that is to say, the structural change that I think is occurring as a result of a very large shift in relative prices, that's what the terms of trade is, that structural change, as I say, that's really a synonym almost, a synonym for improved productivity performance. That's my hypothesis. What I'm saying tonight is I've only got one observation in the data that's consistent with that so far. I hope I get some more, but time will tell. Ian Harper.
Thanks, Glenn. Stephen Martin mentioned that you're one of two Australian officials who are members of the Financial Stability Board. And I wonder if I could draw you on your views about the evolution of financial regulation, both internationally and here in Australia since the global financial crisis. So to be specific, are you comfortable about the trends that have emerged from the Financial Stability Board and their application to our circumstances here in Australia? And depending upon the answer to that question, can I draw you on the likely impact of the regulatory trends that we've emerged, that we've observed, and their impact on the structure of the Australian economy over the next 5 to 6 years or so?
Well, you asked the question of someone who, when he attends Financial Stability Board meetings, travels further than others, than anyone else, and therefore endures more jet lag and has the latest start time to the conference calls, which is usually 11 p.m. So at times I sort of may have an unduly jaundiced view of the process. The first point is, I don't think there was any, having seen what happened, we've had a major financial crisis. There were clearly some failings in the supervisory and regulatory process. I think it's hard to deny that. We didn't have them here, I don't think. I think our supervisor did a good job, and I would say, as I've said before, I think by and large our major financial institutions were quite carefully managed, and that's to their credit. But in other countries, they did have problems. So you're always going to have some kind of regulatory response to that that event. I don't think there's any doubt that the largest global players, the dozen or 15 really genuinely G-SIFIs, to use that expression, did not have enough capital. They were over-leveraged and they suffered liquidity problems as well, partly as a result of the balance sheet strains. You can't let that persist. You have to try to, I think, reform the system to have more capital in institutions like that, higher quality capital, genuine loss-bearing capital, and at least some more attention to liquidity management and so on. Then there's a whole bunch of other agendas under the FSB, but let me just stick with the major institutions. That set of arrangements, by and large, has very little bearing on our banks. Our banks are not G-SIFIs. They will be D-SIFIs. They will be, under the systemic framework for domestic institutions, they will be captured. And that will say to hold a little bit more capital, not on the same magnitude as your JP Morgans and these other very, very large global banks, but a little bit more. I don't think it will actually be that hard for them to meet that by the time it comes in, which is some years away. I think one has to accept that it's likely that in the global banking system, yes, insisting on more capital to lessen the probability of the state having to step in again, it raises the cost of intermediation to the community. That's correct, but I think, in all honesty, the community just has to accept that because the price of intermediation appears to have been too low before, and I think we've got to accept some change there. Of course, we have to modulate that, calibrate it, and I suppose, to come to your question, the thing I've found perhaps a bit unnerving about all the regulatory reform process is the sheer speed with which very important decisions have been made. I understand the sense of urgency that we don't feel here, but my peers in America or Britain or Europe do feel. You can see why they feel that. Nonetheless, Basel II took 20 years to negotiate. Basel III took 18 months to agree. It comes in over a long time, but that was a very accelerated process of agreement. We're already finding in certain areas that some quite influential countries are feeling the need to tweak some of the parameters. So there's a risk of unintended consequences if you're not careful that comes with speed. I've felt myself a little uncomfortable with that. Most of these things I don't think are going to be a great drama for us. Some attention to capital, but APRA has always had pretty conservative definitions of capital. Therefore, the capital shortfall that would exist under the new rules is much smaller generally for our banks than it would be for many others. That reflects very well on APRA. And on the liquidity side, which was the other big thing, we've managed to find a way of handling the needs there. So I think for Australia, this is manageable. For the globe, it's a lot of progress in a very short time, and we need to be very attentive to the possibility of unintended consequences. And I think that extends not just to bank regulation, it extends to the work on OTC derivatives clearing, it extends to things like Volcker rules, etc., and the European equivalents. All these things, it's going to be some time, I think, before we know for sure whether we've pitched them exactly right. But I think that's just almost, unavoidable in the circumstances we're in. That's a long-winded answer, but I think that is an important question.